I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. President Donald Trump is planning his re-election campaign launch in Orlando. Former Broward County Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson is arrested on charges including child neglect for his role in the Parkland school shooting. And State Attorney Aramis Ayala isn't running for re-election, so who's vying for the role of top prosecutor in Orange and Osceola County? Today on Intersection, we're going behind the headlines with these stories and more with political analysts Frank Torres and Jason Henry. And we're taking your calls. What did you make of the president picking Orlando to launch his re-election campaign? Did former Deputy Scott Peterson deserve to be arrested? And what legacy does State Attorney Ayala leave behind? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter as well with your comments and questions at WMFE Orlando. Joining us in the studio are Republican political analyst Frank Torres. Thank you, Frank.
Good morning.
And Democratic political analyst Jason Henry. Thank you, Jason.
Hey, hey.
We're going to start by talking about the state attorney's race in Orange and Osceola County. Here's Aramis Ayala announcing her decision to not seek re-election in 2020.
After the Florida Supreme Court's decision on the death penalty, it became abundantly clear to me that death penalty law in the state of Florida is in direct conflict with my view and my vision for the administration of justice. Now, as state attorney, those views will not impact the administration of law, and I will continue to follow the law. But I also realize that it's time for me to move forward and to continue the pursuit of justice in a different capacity.
So that's Aramis Ayala, outgoing Osceola and Orange County, the top prosecutor in those counties. Well, Ayala's Chief Assistant State Attorney Deborah Barra says she's running for the seat, which will be vacated in 2020. At a campaign launch this week, Barra said she'll continue with Ayala's death penalty panel. That's a group of legal experts who determine when the punishment should be pursued.
I have seen that it is effective, that we have sought the death penalty repeatedly since it's been enacted, but we have also chosen not to seek the death penalty because it wasn't appropriate.
And when that panel approves the death penalty, Barra says it will be pursued.
There are people out there who fit that harshest penalty category, and it will be used in that manner. It will be used sparingly, but it will be used.
So that's Deborah Barra, who's one of the candidates running for election in Orange and Osceola County for state attorney. Jason Henry, there are quite a few people jumping into that race. Some of the other standouts include former Judge Belvin Perry. What do you make of that?
Yeah, Judge Perry, or Belvin Perry, has indicated that he plans to run next year, January at the earliest, so we're still about 6 months away from that decision being made. But he still has really high name recognition in this area, and if he jumps in, then it's almost like throwing a bomb into that race. It's going to be really tough to beat him. He's an institution in the city of Orlando, in mm-hmm. Orange County, and maybe even parts of Osceola County because of his legacy. Him serving over the Casey Anthony trial. So it's going to be really, really tough to beat Belvin Perry. But I think you have two candidates in that race who are going to do their best to either try to keep him out or try to beat him.
Mm-hmm. Who do you like in that race?
I think if Perry gets in, he's got to be considered the favorite. But I think one thing you have to consider is that the chaos behind this office continues. This is going to be the mm-hmm. fourth straight election, and we're going to have a fourth different Orange Osceola County state attorney in a really important job. And people need to speak up. And I bet you these candidates are going to be listening to this show today. They need to let people know what they think of the death penalty. And while it was brought up a couple times in the last election, we didn't get a real answer. And then when it came up, we were all, shocked, either in support or in opposition of Aramis Ayala's position on the death penalty. And people acted like it was a big surprise. Let's make sure that voters need to make sure their voices are heard and let these candidates know what they think about the death penalty so that we don't have any more situations like the one we're getting out of.
Mm-hmm. What are you expecting from the last year then of Ayala's term? I mean, do you think she'll be more bold with her ideas because she isn't running for re-election?
Oh, yeah, she's going to be bold now. I think you create a completely different version of a politician where they no longer have to re-election to consider in their decision making. I don't think that this announcement of not running for re-election is a sign of retreat by her in any way. I think, if anything, it gives her more space to enact more of her policies to to leave the office in the way that she wants to leave it moving forward. So I can expect some definite unpredictability from between now and when she gets out of office. And I think she'll be sort of an X factor in this race, and she'll throw some really unpredictable twists and turns at the candidates and the voters.
Mm-hmm. As Frank was saying, there has been a little bit of unsettledness to that office,
yeah.
Jason. What about the idea of some of these other things that have been introduced under Aramis Ayala, initiatives like not enforcing bail on low level offences? Do you think some of those things will be rolled back once a term ends?
I think it depends on what the policy is. I think that what you're going to see from these other candidates, especially as it relates to Aramis and Ms. Barra, is that they're going to be wedded at the hip. She announced that she's going to continue the death penalty panel, and that's going to be tied directly to Aramis's legacy and her administration. And the same is going to go for anything that she does over the next year. Belvin. Well, Judge Perry has said that he has no plans of keeping a lot of her policies. Obviously, he'll look at, what some of them are if he is elected or even if he decides to run. And the same thing goes for Ryan. I think he's announced that, he'll take a look at them. But, he wants to ensure that the legacy that she's left behind in that office is completely cleansed from the Ninth Judicial Circuit. So Deborah is going to have to walk a really fine line in, marrying herself too closely to Aramis and trying to get away from some of the policies that were happening in the office, because she was there while Aramis was enacting a lot of these things or all of these things. She's been with the state attorney's office for over 16 years. So, you have a candidate that I believe the other challengers are going to say, no, this is Aramis squared, and she's going to have a tough time fighting against that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to political analysts Jason Henry and Frank Torres. Talking a bunch of big political stories this week. Want to hear from you as well. You can reach out to us at 1-866-338-5252 or on Twitter. We're taking your comments and questions at WMFE Orlando, talking about the race for the state attorney in Orange and Osceola County. Also, tariffs and their effect on Central Florida, the fallout or the blowback maybe from DeSantis and the Florida cabinet's trip to Israel. And the arrest of Scott Peterson, former Stoneman Douglas deputy, who was charged with 17 criminal counts. I want to hear your thoughts on those. 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, let's talk a little bit about tariffs. President Trump has threatened a 5% across the board tariff on Mexican goods that kicks in Monday unless Mexico curbs illegal border crossings. The New York Times reported on Wednesday that Florida imported $7.5 billion worth of supplies, produce or other products from Mexico back in 2018. So just an indication of the kind of impact of trade on Florida specifically. What kind of impact do you think these tariffs are going to have on Central Florida? Frank, what are your thoughts on that?
We get a lot of – we have quite a diversified group of products that we get from Mexico, car parts, different sort of, chemicals and household, appliances. And I think we're going to see those cost hikes in places where we don't normally see them. I think, there'll be a lot of unpleasant surprises when we go to our general use stores and our grocery stores. And I think it's going to sort of sneak up on us first. But on the back end, I think there are a lot of business leaders, a lot of Trump's, bread and butter go-to guys that are also unhappy with this. It's a strange tactic to employ to try to move immigration policy, to try to attack everyone's wallet. It's a fairly unpopular move, although Donald Trump does have some supporters on board with it, but it's going to, it's going to lead to some price hikes and it's going to be some very unpleasant surprises for everybody.
Jason Henry, what are your thoughts? Are Trump's tariff wars on other countries as well as Mexico, like China, are they also damaging to Florida or does it not really have that much of an impact as far as you see?
Yeah, I think it will. I think there was a congressman the other day that said that this is just a bizarre strategy that he's employing. I don't know where this tariff strategy has come from. I know that President Trump's supporters on TV, on radio and in print have said that this is a good strategy, to make America great again. But I know behind the scenes, they're telling them that you got to back off because it's hurting their business, because this cost is going to be passed on to the consumer. And to Frank's point, when you're talking about tariffs and price hikes, it's not going to be something that happens all at one time. It could be something that sneaks up on you. And for consumers, especially for working class folks, When you see a price hike on some of the things that you buy every day, that may be related directly back to his tariff policy.
Mm-hmm. Going to take a call now here. We've got Johnny on the line. Johnny, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And you've got a question about RMS ILO. We'll go for it.
Well, I have a comment, and I have a question for the panel at all. Also, I think I found a great deal of respect for Aramis for her integrity and honesty in bringing forth to light that the death penalty is a costly measure to the state. Now, I've always been a support and proponent of the death penalty, but she made me rethink this thing. I think if we have someone who is truly guilty beyond all reasonable doubt, that they should spend the rest of their life in incarceration. Mm-hmm. And I would like to ask the panel is, what do they think of bringing this measure in front of the voters, like we've done in the past, as a constitutional amendment to end the death penalty? Because I just don't think it's worth it.
Johnny, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate your insight there. Well, I'm going to throw that to the panel. And Jason, over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the criticism that you heard a lot when she announced this policy was that she needs to head to the legislature. This isn't something that her administration, or whether it was Lawson Lamar or Jeff Ashton, could enact because it's put forth in Florida statute. So if that statute is going to be repealed, or if Florida voters are interested in having the death penalty repealed, then it has to go through the Florida legislature. My feelings on it, yeah, I don't agree with the death penalty. But also I know if I was a state attorney, that's a law that I would have to follow.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Frank? I saw you shaking your head as that caller's question came in.
Well, actually, it was more like nodding. First off, kudos to Johnny. I think he should keep speaking up, and I think everybody needs to speak up to their neighbors and these candidates to let everybody know what they think of the death penalty, because it's just a doggone shame that this got through the last election and it didn't become an issue until after somebody was elected. Me, I'm in favor of the death penalty. And as far as a constitutional amendment goes, I think that's the wrong tool to use. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a lot of things away, a lot of powers away from our state attorneys. But I think as far as that call is concerned, tell everybody, tell your neighbors, tell them what you think and get the conversation going so that nothing gets through the cracks again, because it's a powerful issue and a lot of people get emotional about it at the wrong times when it's already too late.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, talking about the race for the Orange and Osceola County State Attorney seat, the death penalty. We're also talking about Trump and the tariffs from the White House to be imposed on Mexico, kicking in on Monday. And also President Trump's decision to pick Orlando as the site of his re-election campaign launch that's coming up in a week or two. What are your thoughts about that? You can reach out to us at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252, or online. We're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, I want to ask you folks, Frank and Jason, what do you think about that move, picking Orlando as the site for this campaign launch at the Amway Center Tuesday, a week from next Tuesday? Why do you think that the president is picking here rather than, maybe South Florida or even another state? What do you think, Jason?
I think he's sticking it to Democrats, to be honest with you. I-4 corridor is very important, obviously, to winning Florida. But not only that, Orange County and the city of Orlando is kind of a hotbed for Democrats. The county is blue. They have a really high voter registration advantage over Republicans and MPAs in the county. And I think that Trump's campaign manager was shrewd in picking this area. He has a really large arena. They're going to fill up the Amway with 20,000 screaming Trump fans. They're going to have a protest down the street. So I thought that from a political standpoint, I thought it was actually kind of smart.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Frank?
I think we're the most important voters in the nation and possibly the world. And, this listening area right here, if you're hearing this, this show, you will likely determine the next leader of this country. And the president knows that. On the other end, I was kind of, discouraged to see no Democratic candidates coming to Orlando for the Democratic gala, which is being held here this weekend. Mm-hmm. They're all up in Iowa, and I understand there's some strategy to that. If there's no Iowa, there's no Florida. But they've got over 20 people running, and not one of them can make the trip down here. I think that's a mistake on their side.
Mayor Pete's husband is coming.
It's about, love candidate spouses. They're the ones who oftentimes do a lot of the work
and don't get the credit.
So, and I believe Kamala Harris is. But come on now. We got 20 candidates in this race, and not one of them can get on a plane and make a five-hour trip to shake some hands down here to the supporters that may or may not deliver them the White House. Give me a break.
To Frank's point, though, I think that that's a – I think what you said was really important. Right. Not that Iowa isn't important, but what makes Iowa more important than Florida? Florida has more minority voters here. Florida is larger landmass. Florida has a lot of agriculture here. So I don't understand why it's so important for all 20 of them to stay in a state that's not going to decide the presidential election.
I'm sure you're not the first person to ask that question, right? I mean, we're probably going to have to unearth some several hundred years of presidential election history to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so a question or a comment rather from one of our listeners here on Twitter. Brandon writes, Orlando, this is about Trump's rally or his campaign launch. I can't wait to go. Hopefully we'll have enough love there to drown out his hate. Keep us up to date on the peaceful protest. WMFE, Frank.
Yeah, I think that's – now that's a very interesting tweet. I'd like to thank that listener for sending it in. That's an interesting issue. I know the city of Orlando has been proactive, but I have concerns about safety at the Amway Center during this event. You're going to have 20,000 Trump supporters, probably 1,000 or 2,000 overflow on the outside, and you're going to have a lot of protesters. There is a lot of construction around the Amway Center. The underpass underneath I-4, that's all construction. Across the street from the Amway Center, that's going to be where the new that's construction where the new entertainment complex is. And I just – when everybody's out there and everybody's emotions are running high, a peaceful environment needs to be encouraged. It's going to be a completely wild scene.
We are taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252, and your comments and questions on Twitter as well. Got a couple other topics to get to here, so I want to just run through them as quick as I can. Scott Peterson, former Stoneman Douglas deputy, he was the deputy who was in the news in the aftermath of the shooting in Parkland, as somebody who was basically kind of holding his position as that shooting went on. Kind of a surprise arrest, though. Frank, what do you make of it? What level of responsibility should that former deputy bear for what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School?
I believe one lawmaker's called him the coward from Broward, and I think that's accurate. I mean, we'll find out more as the case goes on, but you know, I think it's completely warranted. And I think there's going to be a lot of things that come out when we're going through the process.
What do you make of that, Jason Henry? I mean, does it seem politically motivated at all?
I think this is all political. We had the officer in the Pulse tragedy that engaged the shooter outside but never went inside of the building. And while he was hailed as a hero, there were some folks calling him a coward as well. So it'll be interesting to see if these things stick. One thing that that I thought was interesting about this is that the bill that they just passed, the legislature just passed, armed teachers, this may open them up to receive charges the same that Scott Peterson has if they fail to engage a shooter. So, you know, we talk about slippery slopes a lot, and I think that we are headed toward one if, God forbid, we do have another school shooting tragedy in this state.
Because of
the Guardian program that they updated and passed, and now they're allowing teachers to carry guns. If that teacher does not engage a shooter, that teacher may be charged. And I think that's unfortunate, in my opinion.
But Frank, we should bear in mind too that a lot of school districts have said we are not going along with this. I mean, the legislature has said you can do this if you want, but most schools we've seen have said no.
That's correct, and I think Jason has Jason's accurate with his remarks. But you know, I want to see some numbers with that. I want to see how many actual guardians we're going to have in Florida. I bet you it's not going to be that many. Number one, the training requirements are pretty extensive. And it's a lot of responsibility, and why I believe and while personally I was in favor of the legislation, I believe that if teachers want to be armed, they should be able to. I don't think you're going to have a lot of people stepping up to do it because of both the Jason's points of being held liable if they don't act correctly, and because of the extensive training requirements it requires to be able to carry one in school anyways.
There is some money set aside from that, though, too. I mean, I just sort of wonder how that's going to play out in future years as schools have to sort of factor that into their budgets, too. I mean, let's not forget that public schools are always looking for money here and there. So going forward, how big of a deal is that going to be?
I think that there's going to be some flexibility with the budgets. I think if, you know, that money will not go unspent. I think if it's going towards a pot or a program where it's not being used, then the school boards will speak up and the legislators will act.
Mm-hmm. So not too long ago, a week or two back, the entire Florida cabinet sort of up sticks from Florida and went to Israel for a cabinet meeting. Kind of unprecedented there. I mean, this governor, Ron DeSantis, has been pretty explicit about saying he's going to be the most pro-Israel governor the state has seen. He's sort of delivering, making good on that. But some concerns there about holding the cabinet meeting many thousands of miles away from Tallahassee, out of the sight of viewers. Of course, some of that meeting was streamed. There was obviously ways to kind of look at it after the fact, but some concerns there. Jason Henry, was it worth it, do you think, for this cabinet to make that trade mission / cabinet meeting in Israel?
I don't think so. I think you could have had a trade mission without the cabinet meeting. I know that the reporters that went on the trip weren't allowed to carry their laptops or phones inside of where they were hosting the meeting because of security concerns. I think that all should be taken into account. The governor has indicated that he plans to do another trip, maybe not to Israel, but to another place to have another cabinet meeting outside of the state. I think anywhere that, voters and residents of the state aren't able to view or ask questions or be in the sunshine, I guess. I think that, yeah, we should look at that. I think that that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Concerns there from you, Frank?
No, not very many. I think for the most part, it was more of a ceremonial function. And most of the viewers of these cabinets, the very few people that watch the cabinet meetings, are watching it from a stream anyways. Mm-hmm. And whether that stream's coming from Tallahassee or from Israel, the information is going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Also, DeSantis, a Republican governor, doesn't have a monopoly on that cabinet anymore. Nikki Fried,
mm-hmm.
Democrat commissioner of agriculture, is there. So there is, a opening for objection should something go through that doesn't necessarily doesn't necessarily agree with everybody that's being part of the mm-hmm. meeting. So I think it was blown a little bit out of proportion. I think it was something interesting to do and a gesture to the Israeli people that, we're serious about having a relationship with them.
Mm-hmm. Call in here from Doug. Doug, you have some thoughts on this this rally coming up in the last few seconds we have here.
Yeah, I'm a big Democrat, and mm-hmm. in fact, I worked a John Kerry, John Edwards rally at the old arena in 2004. Mm-hmm. But I have no doubt that based on what I saw back then with the security that the Secret Service brought and that OPD had, that they'll be able to adequately protect this rally. I really wish he would go somewhere else, but,
You don't have any security concerns, or...
What's that?
You don't have any security concerns, though. Political differences aside.
Concerns. My biggest concern is they'll try to push the protesters too far away from the event.
Mm-hmm. Doug, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate all your calls and tweets this morning. Just before we end the show, something non-political, although, of course, one might say that all sports is political in some regards. Jason, you're going to be watching the NBA Game 4 tonight.
Absolutely. Clay's back. Clay is back. It's 2-1. Toronto's up 2-1. The Warriors got to get back on track. I'm not a huge Warriors fan, but I can't get with Toronto, man.
Mm-hmm.
Can't.
What are your thoughts there, Frank?
One team's in the United States and the other one is not.
Thank you, Frank. There you go.
I mean, listen, I love that Toronto team. I love the culture they have up there in Jurassic Park. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a really neat fan base, and I think the Magic could learn a lot from what they have going on in both of those markets.
What are your feelings on Drake, speaking of the fan base?
Yeah, I wish we had a fan like Drake. I wish we had five Drakes on the Magic sidelines. I think it makes a heck of a difference, and it draws non-sports fans into the event, so I think it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, talking to Jason Henry, Democratic political analyst. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. Thank you as well, Frank.
Happy National Donut Day.
Yes, indeed. Important news there. Still to come, a farmer's market without the sweat. Mark Baratelli takes a staple of city living and brings it indoors. We'll have that interview when we return in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Do you love farmers' markets but hate the summer heat? Daily City publisher Mark Baratelli may have the answer. This weekend he launches his newest concept for Orlando, an indoor farmers' market. So you've got a new venture you're starting this weekend. It's an indoor farmers' market. Tell me about the rationale for this and what it's going to be.
I think people, as evidenced by the attendance at all the farmers markets in the region, they love farmers markets. They love getting out and shopping and buying. And during the summer, it gets incredibly hot. So I thought, what if I can bring almost all the aspects of a typical farmers market, which are vegetables, produce, meat, bakers, bread makers, dessert makers, 100% food, all-you-can-drink mimosas, lunch options, dessert options, and then bring it inside. I thought that might be a nice product that people would go, I'd like to go try that. All of our produce is 100% local. There is no supermarket that has 100% local produce. There is no farmer's market that has 100% produce. The only one in Central Florida that is 100% local is the Audubon Park Farmer's Market.
Mm-hmm. And where did you get the idea for it? Like, were you at a farmer's market? You're like, man, this is just too hot. I've got to go home.
I love farmers markets. And yeah, I think in 2009, I started exploring our farmers markets. And I just remember sweating so much. And I like to be outside. Like, I'm an annual pass holder. I like to go to Disney. But I felt like at the farmers market, it was an unnecessary, uncomfortability, is that a word, factor in just trying to get your groceries and shopping. The idea came from two places. Number one, I have been to farmers markets. I love them. And I thought putting them inside would be an amazing idea. And number two, there is a brilliant visionary owner of several bars downtown. They own Celine. And he approached me and asked me if I would want to do some type of market. And I said, what type of market? He said, I don't know. I said, is it weekly? I don't know. Monthly? I don't know. Do whatever you want to do. So last year, I brought him Orlando Flea. So we did that two times last year. And then this year, when I was putting together my what do you want to achieve this year, one of them was this indoor farmers market idea. And I realized I have to do it during the summer because that's the hottest time. It'd be the most demand for a product like this. So it was the combination of knowing that there was a need, knowing that people potentially would want this because it does solve a problem of it gives you everything at a farmer's market, but completely inside and air conditioned and no sweating, and the opportunity the owner of the venue presented to me.
So how big is the venue?
10,000 square feet.
Okay, so you got a lot of space.
A lot of space. It's two stories. Now, I'm starting with 23 vendors, so I wanted to keep – I didn't want to do a huge, gigantic market because I didn't know if anyone would show up. So, yeah, it's a huge venue, so we have plenty more space. So if people come on the June 9th date and they like what they see and they tell us we want more vendors, we can definitely add more vendors.
So once you decided this is what I'm going to do, how long did it take you to wrangle all your vendors and get everything lined up? Because I imagine it's quite a lot of work getting everybody together and saying, okay, this is it. We're launching it today.
So I thought about this question. So when you tell people how long it takes to put on an event and then they walk into the event and they're like, what? How long could it take to, you know, this is just people and tables and chairs and a bar and the bar was already here. What did you do? But it's a lot of behind the scenes work. There's a lot of wrangling. The vendors so it took about 2 to 3 months to put this together from absolute scratch. It's a ton of time. And it's not like an 8-hour a day, 7-day-a-week job, obviously. But the reason it took so long is because I really wanted quality vendors. There are a lot of vendors in Central Florida, and I wanted ones that not only were at the top of their game at existing farmers markets, but I also wanted to bring in brands that I loved and respected that had a good reputation in the foodie community who do not even appear at farmers markets. So I wanted to catch you off guard. So if I say, here's an indoor farmers market, okay, you know, fruits and vegetables. Wait. Stasio's Italian Deli is going to be your bread provider. Wait. Orlando Meats is going to be your meat provider. You know, presenting locally known brands in a totally different environment, I thought would be another reason for people to say, I think I'll give this a shot.
So did you then have to convince some of these vendors to kind of get out of their, you know, where they normally sell their stuff and do this kind of pop-up experience?
You know, it was funny. In most instances, these brands were very game. It didn't take much arm twisting. The Stasio's was like, yeah, immediately, let's do it. Orlando Meats was totally into it. Where I came into an unknown difficulty was that I learned that if you're going to do a summer market, the reality of doing 100% local produce is that all the local produce growers, some decrease tremendously their output, and almost to the point of no – one of the growers I talked to even shuts down completely during the summer. So I'm about to launch a summer market, and I – as I'm gathering produce vendors, I'm like, oh, all of you stop growing everything during the summer. That was difficult too. But I got three great produce vendors that are 100% local.
You've got Fleet Farming on here too. And Fleet Farming, they're typically out and about sort of harvesting stuff from people's front yards, right? Mm-hmm. So is that's the produce they're going to be selling?
Yeah, they take people's yards and they grow these beautiful gardens and then they harvest it and they sell a lot to restaurants and then they do a few farmers markets as well. Yeah.
Okay. So, was there anyone that you really wanted to get but you couldn't quite twist their arm to do it this time?
Yeah. And I let me tell you, like, I would approach vendors and at markets, not like hassling them or anything, but just introducing the idea, or hey, can I tell you about this or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some of them would not give me the time of day. Some of them, I repeatedly gave them my email address. I would email them, no answer, no response. And you just have to step back and go, okay, well, eventually I want to work with these people. So we're just going to step back. I'm going to do my event. And maybe if they, you know, hear through the grapevine, the farmer's market grapevine, that this event was good, maybe they'll come over. But mm-hmm. part of me wants to kind of go, oh, you didn't want to answer my emails. Well, I don't really have space for you. No, I'm not going to do that. But you know,
but you'd be hoping they'll show up and just take a look around and get a feel for it anyway, right?
I hope that they show up. But I know, like, I run food truck events, so I know that those vendors talk to each other online, mm-hmm. offline. So I know that if this market is a hit, knock on wood, that word will spread to other vendors. And what I also learned about some vendors are like, yes, they sell produce, but they sell produce like 90% of it goes to restaurants and they'll only go to one farmer's market. And they are not interested in appearing anywhere else, no matter if there's all you can drink alcohol, no matter if it's air conditioned, no matter if it's downtown and super cool. They are like, this is what I do and I'm not interested, which was a surprise.
Yeah, it must be tough. So you mentioned food trucks and I mean, people know your name and they know that that's kind of been one of the things that you've made a name for yourself in the city, right? Like your food truck bazaar has got a great reputation. Tell me about that. Are you still investing a lot of time in the food truck bazaar?
Yeah, that's my jam. I mean, we started in 2011 with one event. It kicked off the Central Florida food truck scene. It turned Central Florida from a food trucks on the street scene into an events scene. And we started with one event in Orlando. We spread to like 10 cities. And it grew. And within two or three years, we were named, the city of Orlando was named the most food trucks per capita, like the biggest food truck city in America. Mm-hmm. And it was because of the nature of how we went, were events based versus just kind of poking along on the street. And if you notice, if you go through the history from 2011 till now, there has never been, like in other major cities, a fight between food trucks and the city. And the reason is because of we went event based. And we went off the streets and we went into parking lots. And that's what Orlando has most of, is parking lots. So, you know, yeah, and that's still going. And now mm-hmm. I do it in other cities. That's like my bread and butter. That's the thing that is like, it just will not die, luckily.
Right. and there's, you see that some of these new kind of venues that are springing up, like
a la carte.
Yeah, a la carte. Mm-hmm. And then the Hourglass District, they're, you know, they have kind of like space for food trucks. So mm-hmm. is that sort of like a sign of just how embedded the food truck scene is in Orlando, do you think?
I think it's a sign, I mean, as someone who's been in it from day one, it's a sign that we did an excellent job at putting down roots, creating this scene in the very beginning so that you have so many trucks to choose from. And I think also these were the natural steps. This is the natural next step, is permanent spots for food trucks to be in. I met with the city like 3 or 4 years ago and told them that food truck lots are the way to go and can we partner together. It ended up not happening. But I'm excited to see these things because these are projects that I, you know, I'm a scrappy little startup, or I don't know, continue to be a startup. You know, I'm used to like doing 10 events a month in a parking lots in this city and that city. So I'm excited to see other people get into the business and bring new audiences to these, to the trucks.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we're seeing them at places like the theme parks too now. So they've kind of glommed onto that idea too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to toot my own horn again. I did the first, Disney's first food truck event was me and Disney partnered together in their, it was still called Downtown Disney back then, before mm-hmm. Disney Springs. And it was a super duper hit. And they do food trucks. And I met with Disney and we talked about their food trucks. And I would love to talk to them more about food trucks mm-hmm. and the experience that one gets from waiting in line to getting the food. There's this whole chain of things that has to happen to communicate to people that this is an authentic experience.
Right. So I'm guessing if this is a success, this is going to take up quite a bit of your time through the summer anyway. If the indoor farmers market takes off, you come back, is it going to be a weekly event?
So we're doing this one event on June 9th, and to answer your question, yes, I hope that people knock down my doors and say, we love these vendors. We love this venue. We love the $15 all-you-can-drink mimosas. We love the fact that you are very, very picky about which vendors you let in. We want this to come back every week. The demand has to be there. People, and the way that they show me demand is they can tag me and give me a lot of feedback online, but the biggest way is to buy products. I mean, it sounds basic, but the vendors have to sell products. If the vendors are selling products at this market, word will spread and the vendors will want to return. I am nothing without the vendors. And in order to keep this level of vendors, we have to make sure that they're having excellent sales, or at least decent sales, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it would be great to do a summer's market, potentially maybe every week, but just for the summer, to create a product that allows you to shop excellent vendors in a farmer's market environment, but it's not outside, it's not sweaty, and it's got a little alcohol involved. Oh, we also have coffee, and we also have kombucha, so we're trying to think of everything, and lunch. So, and I tell people it's like a 30-minute experience, like any farmer's market. You're going to park, you're going to walk, you're going to come in, spend about 30 minutes walking around, grab lunch, get drinks, and then, you know, head out and do your next Sunday adventure.
Mm-hmm. Do other cities have something similar?
That's a good question. I'm sure they do. I didn't invent the indoor farmers market idea at all. Mm-hmm. But I got the name on Instagram, so that means something, doesn't it?
Right. Sure. Mark Baratelli, publisher of The Daily City, talking about the indoor farmers market, which debuts this Sunday, June 9th. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still to come, we continue our showcase of local tiny desk favorites with Seek and Find. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to continue now with our Tiny Desk local favourites. Seek and Find is a trio from Orlando, Blake Trent on guitar and vocals, Trisha Kennedy on drums, and Patrick Langorand on bass. Their entry in the NPR Tiny Desk contest was a song called Belong.
Told was I always had to earn my place, and if I was dirty, they'd have never shown my face. You think I ever found my way through the maze, or do you know I've been lost looking for hell for days? So are we gonna sit and argue about my purity, my moral failings? God help my maturity. Hey, from where I'm sitting, ain't gonna happen for me. And where I belong, where I belong. Is this my home? Seems to me like I'm a misfit. Yeah. so easy for everyone to get it. It's not till now that I realize that they never meant it. Like my words seems to you that are offensive. Hate to break it to you, ain't a cookie cutter world we live in. You're telling me, got it wrong my entire life, that the truth I thought I knew was really just a lie. I am my world, I did, that means do or die. You already said yes, there's no goodbye. You say I belong, say I belong. This is my home. To belong, it ain't about what I did, it's what's been done for me. I finally see the forest through the trees. Guess I got it mixed up, guess I got it wrong. Thought I had to earn my right from you. To belong, it ain't about what I did, it's what's been done for me. I finally see the forest through the trees. Say I belong, say I belong. This is my home.
That was Seek and Find with a song called Belong, their NPR Tiny Desk contest entry. We spoke to guitarist and vocalist Blake Trent during a showcase of Tiny Desk local favourites at the Abbey in Orlando last month. All right, so Blake, tell me a little bit about the formation of the band. You haven't been around that long, but it seems like you've got pretty good chemistry.
To say the least. So, fun fact, I know that they say, kids, don't go anywhere with strangers that you meet on the internet, unless they are Trisha Kennedy. We actually met on Instagram, fun fact. She had a photo with a famous musician, and I was like, oh, she's connected. This is my ticket. And so I hit her up and was like, hey, do you play music? We met the next day, and I had to go to Atlanta in like a couple of weeks, and my drummer, who had been playing with me, he had other stuff that he had to do, and he couldn't go. And so I asked Trish, who I just met, like, hey, do you want to go to Atlanta? Fun fact about that, we didn't kill each other, obviously, but we didn't actually even end up playing any of the shows we went up there to play. It was like this huge disappointment, other than the fact that we met each other, and it was, we just knew. We knew that it was the right thing, and had this like whole long journey, basically, of us exploring the fact that, yeah, we're supposed to be in a band. So, and then, again, strangers on the internet. We found Patrick off of Craigslist. Give it up for Craigslist! Yeah, we know y'all are cheap, come on. And he'd have been in a band that we'd known before, and we were like, so we contacted them. We're like, hey, are we stealing your bass player? And they were like, no. We're doing different things now. So Pat joined us, and from the moment we met, it was a match made in heaven. We've been together ever since. All like 2 months. So
tell me a little bit about the process of writing the song that you entered in the Tiny Desk contest. How did that come about?
So I've discovered that my process is to write songs and then let them sit for 2 months. And then cover that song, and then that's the song. So obviously, as you can tell, I'm a white guy. And I decided to write a rap, and then it was horrible. So I left it alone, and I didn't touch it. And then 2 months later, I'd been listening to a lot of Delta Blues, and I pulled out those lyrics. I was like, hey, sounds good. I think I could make a song with that. I could make a song with that. And then Belong was born. And these guys jumped on board and were like, yeah, let's do that. So that's honestly, it's nothing glamorous. It's just a sad rap.
It's amazing what a guitar riff will do to a song.
Right.
So you started kind of writing professionally as far as music goes as a way to, as sort of a sense of catharsis for yourself. Tell me a little bit about that.
So I personally, you know, is it okay with y'all if we get vulnerable? Yes? We good with that? So I struggled a lot with depression and anxiety, and as I'm sure a lot of us all have. And I realized that I had been taught, I think from a societal sense, just to kind of maintain my own emotions and just deal with it internally. And then I realized that wasn't working out really well for me. And I couldn't quite connect with the songs that I was listening to on the radio because, you know, I grew up in that whole, like, alt-rock generation. We were all like, we have problems. Yeah, we have problems. But nobody was doing anything about it. We were stuck at the we have problems part. And I wanted to write music that helped me move past where I was, not just to recognize the state that I was in, because it's good to recognize that, but then to come from that into something better, to move from the brokenness into something healthy. And so writing this music has been that cathartic process for me.
And as far as giving you an outlet, I mean, does a guitar solo, does that help? Is that therapeutic?
Other than feeding my own ego, probably not, but I'm not that great of a guitar player, but we have fun. We have fun.
And you, I mean, this is not your day job. This is a labor of love, I guess, for you.
Not yet.
But you're still performing and practicing 15, 20 hours a week. I mean, that's quite a lot on top of a day job too.
My boss certainly thinks so. Yeah, fun fact, I'm during the daytime, I'm actually a commercial real estate agent. So live your dreams, kids. Be a rock star.
And that interview with Blake Trent was recorded at the Abbey in downtown Orlando last month. Seek and Find was one of the groups that submitted a video for NPR's Tiny Desk contest. You can watch all of those entries over on our website, wmfe.org. And to take us out, Seek and Find with a song called Run Boy Run. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Technical direction for today's show from Juan Gualda. Production assistance from Danielle Pryor. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.